Howdy, everybody, and thanks for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And as always, I never get tired of saying it. Es mi amigo, Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I hope everybody's doing good out there on this Columbus Day special.
Was you rowing it in today?
Yeah.
Just rowing along.
Right.
I hope everybody that's celebrating it's having a good day off. Everybody else that doesn't celebrate it or isn't celebrating it, y'all should have just taken the day off.
I'm celebrating the fact that it's a day to take off. I don't celebrate Christopher Columbus.
I'm just taking the day off.
Right.
The reason I'm taking the day off, I'm not going to set the mood for the show. We're going to have a great show. We lost a very dear friend of the family's this weekend, kind of suddenly, and it's been a very rough few days. So that's why I'm taking off. So we're going to have a great time today, though. We are going to be talking about some pre-Columbian visitations, something that may or may not be a hoax we're going to talk about. We're going to have some fun. But before we get into that, we are going to have a good discussion, as always, about some interesting news. And I've got some interesting news for you, Mr. Filson.
Please, share.
You remember whenever the Three Stooges broke the beard off of King Tut's mask?
Yeah, I remember that.
Remember? It's all funky the way they put it all back on there.
Yeah.
Well, they're going to restore it now. Egypt has had enough. They're done. They're starting the restoration on the mask. They're re-breaking it, clearing that crap off of it. And this is how I'm assuming they're going to do it. I'm speculating. And they're going to put it back
on
there.
I mean, if the people aren't familiar and you haven't been keeping up, months ago we had talked about this.
A year ago.
Okay. One of the curators accidentally knocked the beard off of King Tut. I mean, we're talking about a priceless artifact.
Off of King Tut's mask, the golden mask that everybody saw, snapped the goatee right off of it. Well, when they epoxied it back on,
it
looked
job.
Like people with no thumbs was trying to put that thing back
on.
It's
crooked. You could see the glue. I mean, who's running that show?
You realize not 50 years ago they'd have taken that person out or persons and shot him.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, for real. That'd have been like, okay, that's it. That's what you get for being a dum-dum. A German-Egyptian team will remove the mask from the display at the Egyptian Museum in Cairo to repair it in another area, they went on to say. Now, of course, they're going to have to do a little grinding and all that stuff on the epoxy to get it all off. But you know what? I think it's due time that they take this bad boy off of there and get it going. And I'm sure there's probably people that are like, that's what they do.
You would think.
I don't know that I have the nerves for that job. My job's pretty stressful at times anyway. I can't imagine having the nerves. You're like, okay, man. It's kind of like being a brain surgeon. You don't get a oops. You don't want to hear your surgeon go, oops. You don't want to hear that. Just like you can't hear the guy working on the mask.
I wouldn't want to be responsible for all those antiquities anyways.
No.
Have somebody carry something and they're like, be careful, don't drop that. And instantly you start feeling more nervous with it.
You're like it's getting
heavier.
If
you didn't say nothing, I wouldn't even think of it.
Yeah.
But the moment you say, oh, please don't drop that, that's like 200 years old.
That's why I don't go into like antique stores. I know I'll knock stuff. I just don't go anywhere near it. It's better that I don't.
I'm clumsy anyway. My wife always tells me I'm like a bull in a china shop.
I'm loud.
I knock stuff over.
Yeah.
I stub my toes at least once a week. I mean, it's ridiculous. Moving on. Have you ever noticed, and several people have made mention to it, it's been brought up in other movies and things like that. We've joked about it amongst ourselves for years. You ever see these old photographs, and you always wonder why the people never smile?
Yes.
In the old photographs. Do you know why that is?
I heard because it took so long to take the photo.
Well, there's an article, and this comes from Vox.com.
And that if you smiled, it was shown it was a sign that you was crazy, as I saw that from A Million Ways to Die in the West.
Okay, yeah. Well, this is an article from Vox.com. It's talking specifically about why people never smiled in these old photographs from the early 1900s. And they say, number one, like you're saying, the technology made it hard to capture smiles because of the exposure time and things like that. It took a while, but this one's I never thought of, that early photography was heavily influenced by paintings. Which means that the whole photography thing, they weren't.
So they told you not to smile?
Well, everybody up until this point, if you think about it, this is new technology. This is cutting edge for these people. All they're accustomed to their whole life, they've never seen photographs. They've only seen paintings. So when they modeled or posed for these pictures, they just kind of sat there like you would if you were going to have an artist paint you.
I got it.
Because, you know, when people used to just sit, they say that was
another
reason.
I've had that done.
Right?
I've actually had that done. I laid out like one of your French girls. All
right. Right. They say also that when we snap a picture of a profile today, we use it as a way to document the moment at hand. But in the early days of photography, people thought that somehow this photography would grant you some kind of safe passage into immortality. And that's a little bizarre, right?
Mm-hmm.
They say also that in the Victorian and Edwardian cultures, of the time that people actually looked down on smiling. Isn't that crazy? They looked down on it. It's like, don't smile. That's rude in public to smile. Can you imagine that? Who's against smiling?
Probably because life was so hard. There was no fun back then. Right? What was fun back then? Nothing.
I don't know.
Except maybe waking up. That was fun. Other than that, that's pretty much all
you
had. You
weren't very far off. I mean, they really thought that smiling was for idiots. And like, if you were to smile in the photograph, that's just something only an idiot would do.
I guess I'm an idiot because I smile a lot.
Yeah, right. Me too. Everybody likes to smile.
Yes.
I will say this, you know, with the selfie craze and things nowadays, I will say that my sister-in-law was taking selfies long before cameras were on phones. I mean, I remember like, 20 years ago, you get her, you can see a picture of her as a kid taking selfies. So, like, she's one of the original selfies.
And she's crazy.
She is crazy.
So that proves it right there.
I got
all
me
the
a
smiling.
Selfie stick.
You do have a selfie
stick. I bought one last week.
I was going to call you out on that, and I totally forgot. You got a selfie
myself
stick.
At, well, actually, I use it for work.
Yeah, sure
I have to take
does.
Pictures of the attic and crawl spaces and stuff, so now I just stick my phone on there.
Get your selfie stick on.
Right? I'm going to have to Periscope with my selfie stick. That's coming up soon. You know what? The whole Periscope thing, we are trying to get people to tune in for that. It's kind of already died.
We got to do some more.
I mean, I know it still exists, but I'm saying when that app first came out,
there
was Periscopes going off like crazy. Half the people I follow now, they don't do it either.
Just forgot about doing
it
all the time.
The newness kind of wears off. I mean,
we'll have to do it some more.
Apparently, you could do some live streaming like that on Facebook now.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know how you do it.
You don't?
No. Dude, when our website got hacked, it took me 2 weeks to figure out what the heck was going on.
I got
people give me too much credit. They really do. I get
That's
emails
true.
From people all the time.
That's
and they
so
try
true.
To they try to help me, and they ask for all these different commands and stuff for a computer. I'm like, dude, I don't know what you're talking about.
I got it turned on.
Well, you know, on your website, I'm like, you have given me way too much credit. I know nothing.
We got to start recording our phone conversations we have every day too. That's going to be a plus, yeah, for sure.
I got a lot of editing in there.
Did you know that DARPA has built something else?
I did not know that, but I'm sure I would assume that they would. Yeah, what
gonna,
do we got now?
You're going to like this. Brother, this is from
robotic
the Washington
snakes.
Post. It's called the Mars Robot, M-A-A-R-S, for Modular Advanced Robotic, I'm sorry, Modular Advanced Armed Robotic Systems. And when I say armed, I don't mean to give you a hug, Kyle.
Yeah.
I mean armed. So, it kills human targets from almost 2 miles away.
Oh, that's handy.
It has motion detectors, acoustic sensors, sirens, and speaker systems, non-lethal like tasers on it, and encryption technology that makes the robot killer extremely safe and tamper-proof is what they claim.
Perfect.
Exactly.
Can't wait.
Now, it says several years ago, DARPA began looking into a new medical procedure called transcranial direct current stimulation. Now, to the outsider, the experiment looks more like Mary Shelley than cutting-edge neurology, it says. Now, this is, like I said, from the Post. It says scientists taped sponges laced with metal to various parts of the patient's scalp and then hooked them up to a small 9-volt battery. It says basically like the ones that they put in smoke detectors.
Yeah.
And then they send it, you know, these pulses into your brain to see what would happen.
Handy.
Well, what they found was stroke patients improved motor skills. Chronic pain sufferers appeared to find relief. And then the stimulation seemed to help some patients with learning. And it was the last thing that DARPA found the most intriguing was the learning. So now they've gave scientists at the University of Mexico a grant to see whether the TDCS might have military applications. So it sounds like to me that this is going in a bad, bad, bad way. Now, Annie Jacobson explores this, what she says, this tension in her new book called The Pentagon's Brain, and she presents what is the first comprehensive history of an agency many Americans don't even know exist, and they talk about DARPA's from the beginnings, which I'm going to get you this book, as the informal gathering of scientists struggling, of course, all the way back with the problems in the Cold War all the way up till today, which is with this crazy steering. They've got self-steering bullets. They've got all the stuff that they've come up with. So this book is actually going to go and account and talk about everything up until this point.
Wow.
But I love the idea that they talk about being able to shock your brain, give you some things. I've also heard, you know, some people have tried it and it didn't work out so good for them. I know Ben and Aaron tried it and it didn't work out so good for them. Give them all headaches, things like that. But it's funny to me that DARPA is actually getting on board with some stuff already where they want to start messing with your dome and playing around with stuff like that. That's really not a good thing. They've already got all this. So what are they going to do? Are they going to make it to where it's all remote control now with your brain? I mean, is it too much to hold on to a PS4 controller or an Xbox controller? That's too much. Control it with your smartphone. I don't know. But I'm going to have to get you the DARPA book. I'm going to see if I can get somebody at DARPA to sign it for you. You'd
be
rocking.
That would be awesome. I'd love to have the DARPA. Heck, the DARPA book. That'd be great.
You're getting it.
Perfect. Christmas is coming.
That's right. And so are the robots.
Right. And so is the next break. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. I hope everybody's ready to talk a little Columbus. Christopher Columbus. This is Columbus Day. And this is the ridiculous holiday that we celebrate here in the States.
We don't celebrate.
Yeah, right. To honor Christopher Columbus, because he's the first person to discover America. We know how insane that is. And it's also insane that today, I mean, the teachers still teach the kids that. I mean, my kids have been taught that this whole week. Of course, they tell the teacher, my dad said Christopher Columbus did not discover America.
Yeah, right. Didn't discover anything.
But we're going to talk about, you know, we've talked about it before on some shows. I'm going to talk about some more of these other cultures that were here before Columbus. One of them that a lot of people aren't aware of is the fact that the Chinese, there's evidence suggesting that the Chinese people were here.
Nice.
Long before Columbus, probably 70 years before Columbus.
Ooh.
Are you familiar with the 1421 theory?
I think I've read it in one of the, man, we've covered so much of it. I would say yes, but I'll, you know what? No. I'm just going to go with no. So okay. Lay it on me.
Sure. This is a theory by a gentleman named Gavin Menzies, and he's a retired Royal Navy submarine commander, and he's a navigation expert. And he has been researching these pre-Columbian explorers for a while now, and he even took this map that he found, and he presented this into a large audience of diplomats and geographers and fellow naval officers at the renowned Royal Geographical Society. Now, you've heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave a lecture there. And the result of 14 years of his research, there's a man that he was studying named Zheng He. Now, Zheng He was a eunuch with close connections to the Chinese imperial family.
Ooh, y'all share something in common.
Right? And the imperial family, they entrusted him with command of a huge expeditionary force, which comprised of hundreds of ships. And these ships sailed around the world in a worldwide voyage that left in March of 1421 and lasted to October 1423. That's hence the term the 1421 theory, because that's when he believes that they departed on this voyage, okay? Now, amongst other things, he believes that the Chinese mariners were able to calculate latitude and longitude pretty accurately in the southern hemisphere using the Canopus, which is a star. In the northern hemisphere, navigators would use the Polaris, you know, or the northern star to navigate. And he said that they were really good at navigation. These early Chinese sailors, you know, these mariners were very good. And not only were they able to navigate really well, there's some other things. There's traces that have been left here in this country that show that the Chinese were here. One of them is there's at least 9 shipwrecks that have been found in the Caribbean Sea. Or Caribbean Sea, however you like to pronounce it. And he thinks that these wrecked ships are actually part of Zheng He's fleet. And it shows that they were here in the America. In the Americas. Now, Menzies, the guy that came up with this theory, his quest for this, looking for this lost expedition, started back in 1988. When he learned at that time that Portuguese sailors possessed a map of the world accurately representing Africa, Australia, South America, places like that. And this was 100 years before Ferdinand Magellan completed the first known circumnavigation of the globe. So they possessed an earlier map. Go ahead.
I remember this because I touched on this some when we talked about the Newport Tower.
Right.
That's because they had tried to link the lost fleet, the lost Chinese fleet, and the Portuguese sailors to the Newport Tower.
That's exactly right.
I do remember this. Yeah, because it jogged my memory when you brought up the fact of the remains of these shipwrecks that they've started finding.
Right.
Ah, yeah.
So they knew that the Chinese had possession of this map, that the Portuguese had already mapped out, you know, the other continents very well. And this earlier map, the Portuguese map, was discovered in 1428. And they said it was based on charts Spirited out of the Imperial China. And it was taken out of China by a Venetian merchant named Nicola de Conti. And he sailed with Zheng He on part of his worldwide global voyage. So what they're saying is, if you're not following, that the Chinese, the ancient Chinese, they knew the way the world was mapped out. And they had maps. And these Portuguese were actually copies of Chinese maps. And that they really had an ability to navigate and travel. And that's what I like, is so many people scoff at the idea that these large oceans were somehow unpassable, that people couldn't sail or traverse these large oceans. And I just don't think it's true. We've talked about it from time to time. We're always assuming that they're sailing all the way across the middle. But why wouldn't you just follow the land?
Well, we always think that way. The reason I feel we think that way is because we're in such a hurry. You want to go straight line. Let's go straight line. We got to get there. We got to make this as short as possible. I don't know why, as a conscious group, the majority of us make this mindset that everything has to be done in record time. Man, I washed my car in 4 minutes today. Oh, man, I picked up the house in 32 minutes today. You know, it's like you got to sit. It's not about that. And then it definitely wasn't about that. It was about safety. It was about, we know this works. This is the way we go. If you go out that way, it's way harder. Let's stay along this coast. Fresh water, fresh food. If we needed to pull over to the side of the road to the rest stop, we can. And that's the way it was done.
Yeah. And I mean, and it's not just the Chinese. There's numerous cultures that they know, whether it's Irish people. You've heard of that. The Knights Templar. Mm-hmm. You've heard of all the different stories. The Phoenicians, the Minoans. We know about the mining of copper in Isle Royale. This was all happening. So I think that there was a lot of people that had knowledge of the way the continents were mapped out. I think they had maps. I think they had the ability to navigate. I don't think it was hard for them at all. Now, you know, just like we talked about before, many conventional scholars were predictably unimpressed with Menzies' evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they denied that it happened, you know. But despite this official denial that the Chinese, there's no way they could have made it over here, according to mainstream academics, they do agree that the Chinese ships of the 15th century were unquestionably superior to the contemporary European vessels, and they were far more seaworthy and ocean-going. So why they discredit the ability of the Chinese to sail over here, I have no idea.
I don't either, because it's one of those things. I watched, like I may have even told you, a documentary about Japanese craftsmanship at the time, and it was showing that the things that they created without nails and screws.
Yeah.
All done by, and that's the same thing I think about whenever we're talking about old shipbuilding. That's what I think about, is the craftsmanship that it goes into, and knowing just what woods to use and how to do it. The Chinese were excellent at it. Excellent. I mean, and look at, they're still great builders, even though they make, you know, more cheaper things now, but they're still great builders. I mean, they're just a very hands-on type culture. So for me to think of anything, I guess I'm, what is it, a dirty diffusionist? I don't believe that everything came up without knowing of one another. I believe we mixed the same way we do now.
Absolutely. I agree with you. There's a man by the name of Josh Ruskamp. Now, he's a retired chemist and an amateur epigraph researcher from Illinois. And he discovered some unusual markings while walking in the Petroglyph National Monument in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He claimed that the markings that he found there were made by ancient people from Asia. And he believes that they were present in America 1300 BC, or nearly 2800 years before Columbus arrived in the New World in 1492. He even says that these ancient Chinese writings in North America cannot be fake, for the markings are very old and the styles of the scripts are also old. He also says that as such, the findings of this scientific study confirm that ancient Chinese people were exploring and positively interacting with native people over 2,500 years ago. Now, he's a researcher, and he's an epigraph researcher, which means he is familiar with not only the writing, you know, the letters and things, but the writing style of the Chinese. And that's why he's saying that this is impossible to be faked. You got these ancient markings. They have the patina, so you can see that they're old. And you know that the style that it's writing in matches the style of the day. He doesn't think you can fake that. I have to agree with him. I mean, that's pretty good evidence mm-hmm. that it's not a fake. I mean, he says that the script, the way it was written, matches exactly the way the Chinese would write at the end of the Shang Dynasty, which allows him to tell, you know, roughly how old the carving probably is, or the not the carving, but the engraving.
Mm-hmm.
He says that the oracle bone pictograms, or the markings, record a ritual sacrifice offering, which perhaps was exactly what they were doing during the Shang Dynasty. Now, he says that at the time, it was common for people of that time in China to make dog sacrifices, and they were very popular at that time. And so he thinks these pictograms that he found here in North America, in New Mexico, are somebody making a mark talking about the sacrifice that they were doing, you know, to their gods or whatever. And he's like, the writing's the same, the script's the same, and even the practices by whoever's doing it, whoever made the carving, knew of those practices. So how could that be fake? How could it? He even claims that he found a Chinese pictogram of an elephant dating 500 BC in the Petrified Forest National Parks in Arizona. So he thinks that not only did he find these markings in New Mexico and Arizona, he's saying that he knows that this proves to him, at least, that the Asian explorers were moving throughout the lower United States. They were probably intermingling, interbreeding with the Native Americans. I mean, I think it's
it could have been much like
possible,
it is now.
Right? He says that there was even another pictogram recently found in the Grapevine Canyon in Nevada, which is also Chinese script. It looks like Chinese script.
That's pretty strange, isn't it?
So how do you discount the fact that people are finding this? I just don't understand why what's the academic's excuse for something like that? How do you explain? Do you think just anybody is just going to go walk out in the desert, carve a carving into the stone, and they have to know the time period, the rituals, the way to do it? I mean, what's the chances of somebody doing that?
Yeah.
It's a really good troll.
Like we talk about the Kensington Runestone. I mean, you can search it up as a hoax today, even today, and there is tons and tons of stuff online about how it's fake. But if it's fake, they did an awful good job, and they could only find ways of doing it that only correlated until recently, that nobody even knew about until recently.
Yeah.
That correlates it. So it's one of those things. I don't know. I don't know enough about geology. You know, I don't have any idea of how to check the weathering and know. And I know it's a very, very kind of a loose thing to know the age of a carving in stone. I understand that. But still, it's one of those things. It's very, very interesting to me, like what you're bringing up, is not the fact of what they found there. I don't understand why anybody wants to discredit that. So that, what difference does it make? At this point in time, if the Chinese were here, what difference? It makes no difference at all. I love to run that through my head to think about what it was like when they landed here, or, you know, and the trading that they did and all this stuff, because it's like the very first show that we've ever done. We talked about the copper mines.
Yeah.
You can't deny the copper mines.
Can't deny it.
You cannot deny that.
You have this Chinese legends of this Zhang He. And they know this guy existed, the eunuch I'm talking about, that sailed. Like, it was given permission by the imperial Chinese family to sail. They know that this journey happened. They know that they were very good mariners. They knew that they were able to navigate. They know that they found Chinese shipwrecks in the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
Then you find these pictographs in the interior of the United States, in Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico. We're not talking along the coastlines. This is the interior.
Yeah.
So how do you explain all that and think that they weren't here? You know? To me, it's absolute proof. And I'd like to talk about some other things, some other cultures. Of course, we've talked about them before. One of the best, I think, is Columbus himself admits to people being here before him. So once again, he's not even claiming that he's the first person to discover the United States. We have that.
Mm-hmm.
And according to an American historian and linguist, a guy named Leo Weiner of Harvard University, he says one of the strongest pieces of evidence to support the fact that black people sailed to America before Christopher Columbus was a journal entry from Columbus himself. And he says that in the book, he explains that when he first arrived, the Native Americans that he encountered were black-skinned people, and that he approached them in when they landed with their boats, and they were trading with them, and they had gold-tipped spears, which is common to Africans.
That's
so Columbus
cool.
says it himself. How come no one's ever told that? Also, we've talked about it when we were speaking with Frank Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about the fact that Egyptians were found to have traces of cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, cocaine only comes from South America.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another case that proves that the Egyptians were traveling and trading with people in the Americas, you know, whether it's South America, Central America, or North America. We've talked about there's ancient African skeletons that have been found in the New World. Most people don't know this, but there's been many instances of archaeologists actually discovering skeletons and skulls that belong to people of African descent. Are you familiar with a Polish professor named Andrzej Wierzynski? He revealed the discovery of African skulls at Olmec sites in Mexico. This is not just, this is, of course, pre-Columbus. You've seen the giant Olmec heads.
Yes.
Do they not look like African heads?
Yes.
People of black culture. They say that most people don't know that Africans were master shipbuilders, and they were incredible at sailing, and that much of the Sahara Desert now wasn't a desert always. It was actually large lakes, and they were pretty much a water culture, and they all learned how to sail, and that their navigation skills were amazing. Also, Polynesians. Polynesians somehow had access to sweet potatoes. Well, sweet potatoes are native to South America, okay? And they don't reproduce by seeds. They're actually tubers, which means it would be very hard to transport sweet potatoes if it were not done by the intervention of human beings. So to suggest that like a bird ate a seed and then it landed somewhere else, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They say, no, there's the only way for them to get this is it had to be traded by human beings. Well, Polynesians and South America, they have to be traveling by boat. It's simply the only way.
And we've talked about it too. Something with the words.
Yes, they have a very
language is very, very close. Remember, we've talked about this too. Yeah,
yes,
we're very close.
Right, the Maori, the Maori people's word for sweet potato is kumara. Okay, well, the Peruvian word for sweet potato is kumar. Very close.
Very close.
Right?
Close enough. Close enough to make you go, wait a second.
That's a little odd, right? They've also, this is, you know, this has only come to light recently because of the technology and the newfound things with DNA. But they've actually tested some Polynesians and Native Americans in South America. And they actually found some DNA markers that are in Polynesians that are in the Native Americans of Peru and stuff like that.
Oh, that's
so
pretty awesome.
They can prove that there was interbreeding going on. But there's a matter of chickens. They said in 2007, scientists announced a unique genetic marker found in South American chickens, and they are testing them, and they have the DNA of Polynesian chickens. So even the chickens were, the poultry was even interbreeding.
Oh, that's funny.
It's because I think that they came over, and they set up shop. They traded. It wasn't a big deal. The Maori have things that the people of the interior of South America didn't have, and of course they traded. Well, you know. The Japanese, we've talked about this. You've talked about it before, where they've there's things that only Japanese people have, including like disease and things that many people on the West Coast of both the North America and South America, and even genetic links, including a rare kidney ailment that is only shared between people along that Western coast and the Japanese. There's the Irish, we've talked about numerous times. Where there's the Prince Madoc. Remember Prince Madoc?
Yep.
And the Welsh Indians. And
we've had
like
several
that.
Listeners, when I discussed the Newport Tower, send us some links to some cool videos on YouTube that was talking about some of that, that we may have to touch on that again later, because there's some really interesting stuff that they found there.
Yeah. Well, you've heard of the Irish monk, St. Brendan.
Mm-hmm.
He was reputed to have gone on a lengthy sea voyage in the 5th century. I'm sorry. In the 5th century. And many believe that his ultimate destination was North America. And one adventurer named Tim Severin even demonstrated that the journey would have been possible.
Is that Dan's brother?
I guess so. Dan Severin, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's an old UFC fighter, folks. Yeah.
There's all these evidences of all these cultures coming over here. And I think it's fascinating, and I like to bring it up. Every time it's Christopher Columbus Day, it makes me scratch my head and wonder what are we so afraid of? I mean, what would it do? Would it change your life drastically if you woke up next week and they said, look, all right, you caught us. We admit it. Christopher Columbus was not the first person to discover this land.
Well, and he wasn't a good person. Let's just go ahead and get everybody. I don't understand why we. It would be like the U.S. celebrating, I don't know, maybe like an Adolf Hitler Day. I mean, is that what we're going to celebrate? Because that's the way it feels. Because when you really dig deep, and I know that's a shocking thing to say, But he wasn't a good person. And what he brought about with him wasn't good things.
Oh, yeah.
It's not like he went around, you know, just being a nice guy and helping everybody out. It's not the way it really worked out. And you start looking at this, I mean, history is full of atrocities.
And yeah, he was a slave master.
You sit here and preach on one and, you know, and just beat on it. You don't want to do that. That's not what y'all tuned in to listen for. I completely understand that. But I think everybody that's listening to this show, I think we all pretty much agree, maybe 95% of us agree, that we all know he wasn't a good person. And we all agree that no matter what, it shouldn't be taught that he was who founded. Even for all of our international listeners, they also agree it shouldn't be taught that he found this place.
No, I mean, they always make it out, and even in the movies and things, like Christopher Columbus showed up and there was only the Native Americans here, and that was it. It's like, but when you read into the history, you see that there was all types of people here.
Yeah.
Long before.
Well, let me
black-skinned people, you'd have the light-skinned people of the Mandans. You read about the copper mining and things. I think that there was society here, and in addition to the Minoans and the Phoenicians, the Egyptians. I mean, we were talking about the cocaine tribe, and there is evidence that Egyptians were here, sailed up the Mississippi River. They were here.
My thing about it, this whole deal is this. Who sailed and discovered Africa?
Yeah, I don't know.
Who sailed and discovered
Australia?
James Cook. There were people there when he got there.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't matter. Haven't we moved past this to saying I'm first?
No,
who
apparently
gives a
we
damn?
Haven't. Haven't we
get rid of it. It's over. Throw it out. Go, you know what, folks? We don't know. It's okay to say I don't know.
You're right. It is 100% all right to say you don't know, but people won't do that in the academic
field. It's 100%, folks, everybody listening, it's fine to tell somebody, I don't know. Let ego go about everything. You go, I don't know. I don't know who found it. We don't know. We can study it all we want to, and everybody can argue. And I think it's better now if we all said we don't know who found, you know, who discovered the Americas. But what we do know is look at all the information that we've gathered already. Look at all these other cultures that were probably here. And let's take an open look. Let's throw everything out that we first believed. The same as nobody can tell you who discovered Africa. Well, why not? Well, that was too long ago. Well, maybe it was that way here. We just like to put labels on things because dummies.
Don't people think that it's odd that there's pyramids in Egypt and there's also pyramids in Central and South America?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not talking about the smooth ones on Giza. You do realize that there's a lot of other pyramids in Egypt that are stepped pyramids, mm-hmm. just like they are in Central America.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. You know, one thinks that's odd.
Yeah, it's that's the whole idea is drawing little links together. That's
corn.
The stuff that's yeah.
The Egyptians have
exactly.
corn.
Exactly, pineapples.
Right,
looks like drawings of pineapples.
Yeah, and corn.
Mm-hmm.
There's okay. Get this, cotton that grows in North America.
Mm-hmm.
They know that comes only from Africa. It's an African strain of cotton.
How crazy is that?
Because they were here.
They know it. They know it. What do you think? The winds carried it? A bird come over and pooped that
far?
Over here?
Come on,
bird pooped that out. It just grew like that. Come on now. Well, now people are just talking crazy now.
Right. Well, speaking of Egyptians in the United States, Cam, what were you talking about with me before the show? I mean, I know that a lot of people out there are going to be familiar with this, but it is an interesting story.
It's a very interesting story, yes.
Please enlighten us.
I just want to touch base on, I found some information and stuff, and I want to share it with folks because it's an interesting story, if nothing else. It appears to be a complete hoax on the surface, a total fabrication by a con man and a not very good person, but there also may be a little bit of truth to some of this too. This is what makes it so difficult.
Yeah, it is. It's bizarre.
This is, what I'm talking about, folks, is the Burroughs Cave or the Illinois Cave. If you're follow along with Harry Hubbard, we'll start this whole thing off. 1925, spring, beautiful weather there in Orville. Lowry was working in Hickory Hill, which is the southeast corner of Marion County there in Illinois. He's a local guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
You only imagine how beautiful it is up there in the spring. Quiet, yeah, working, whole thing. He's got two daughters. They're helping him move some rocks and some debris and whatnot out of this area that they're going to actually build for a family garden. That's the idea. Now, he had his oldest daughter at the time, was 6 years old. Her name was Fern. So Fern, she starts walking around. She's looking at this edge of this ravine next to the garden spot. And there's a few feet away. There's a bluff. Well, Fern sees a hole cut in sandstone. And it looks like it's by human hands is what she said. So she yells at her dad. And she says, you know, Pop, come over here and check this out. So they start looking at this hole. Well, Orville starts working in there and diligently in that area for years. And he's trying to get professional investigators from the state of Illinois to come out to this site and look at it, to this entrance of what he claims to be this subterranean cavity.
Mm-hmm.
basically, nobody at that time in Illinois even cared. They just kind of laughed off the whole idea that they'd be anything of any sort of ancient significance in Marion County. You know, in Illinois, you're like, how could that be?
How could that be?
Yeah.
Christopher Columbus discovered it in 1492. Does everybody know that?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, so Orville worked, and anyway, he got it recorded in the WPA journals in Salem, the county seat. He got Fern's little discovery recorded there. So at least it was written down, so he did that for his daughter. There was lack of interest in all that, so Orville later, of course, sold the land, and he moved to Mount Vernon, which is about 20 miles away, in the early 30s. So, you know, you're thinking in the early 30s, I'm thinking, so close to 10 years he worked to try to get somebody to look along this, and nothing happened. Well, you know, the family goes, and Fern and her sister there, they grew up there in Vernon, get married, they moved off to different states, and pretty much kind of forgot all and everything about the discovery and all that. And Orville, same thing. He just kind of wrote it off. You know, he's like, you know what? We tried. Nothing really happened. Decades roll on. Decades. 1961, early summer of 1961, there is a treasure guide rider there in the county. And they say he's somewhat famous. His name is Michael Paul Henson. Well, Michael Paul goes up and he talks to Orville after reading about this discovery in the Salem courthouse, just doing a little research to write these little treasure guides. Well, he was excited, Orville was, that there was somebody wanting to listen to his story. Of course, you know, older fella, you know, it's always that way. The old guys always want to tell some cool stories. Hell, imagine how we're going to be. So Orville met with Henson and took him to where this site was. Well, Henson, he wrote several lost treasure books, and anyway, so he had published the information he obtained in these earlier releases. Well, he had often copied Henson's work. Others people did, so they could go back and basically, I guess, do their own little sort of treasure hunting and all this stuff. Well, Orville passed away in 1974, and it was pretty much kind of left alone until again in April of 82. And that's where Russell Burroughs comes into it.
Ah, I see.
He's from Alani also. Well, he had been big into metal detecting and searching up for, you know, just basically relic hunting, going out and looking, you know, trying to find arrowheads, pot shards, pretty much anything he could find. Got big into that. And of course, you know, you get into, you know, metal detecting, you're hoping to find gold pieces and, you know, maybe some, just any parts of old history. It's what's fun. Well, he had gotten into some of these books. So what did he do? He starts taking the coordinates and laying them out on a map and crisscrossing these coordinates. This is his story until he finds where this area
cave,
is.
Right?
Exactly. The story goes he's entered this cavern. And the story also goes that he looted this whole thing for what was sold for billions of dollars worth of gold and artifacts is what was billions, I said, with a B. This is how the story goes. And then, of course, because he was so aggravated with the way things turned out years later, that he dynamited the entrance and sealed the tomb forever.
Yeah, like what were some of the objects that he found?
We're going to get into this whole thing. It got famous for a large number of inscribed stones, and often on these stones there were profiles of people, like you mentioned, that looked African, people looked Egyptian, European, and Native American inscriptions on these stones. The funny thing was, a lot of people say that they looked very crude, which you could imagine at the time. Maybe they were crude. They also claim that they looked like it was an amateur. And Philip Coppins even wrote that he believed, from what he saw and other people had said, that it looked like the work of an amateur or someone meeting an imminent deadline. So like someone's in a hurry. Now, the funny part is the preliminary analysis of the writing on these stones revealed a lot. And the strange part was it was a mismatch of various stylings of writing, various words, languages. They were linguists instantly said fake. They used the word obviously, which is funny because it was written in several other places too that they use the word obvious is what scientists use because they see it so easily faked, and sometimes they like to use it to throw it in the face of amateur archaeologists or amateur researchers that may have been fooled by it. Scientists like to wave that over their head.
Right.
Oh, well, it's obvious a fake. So what we do know is this, that as early as 83, Burroughs took a small collection of these artifacts and he put them on sale in a local antique shop. And it's
I wish I could see some of these artifacts.
You can go online.
No, I mean like in person.
Oh, in the real?
Yeah. To like really turn it in the light and look at it and be like, you know what? This obviously is fake.
Well, and that's what's
funny.
What
if it's not fake, though?
Well.
I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah.
To find this cache of artifacts in a cave on this property, and it's got all these ancient Egyptian carvings and things like that. I mean, what if it's real?
There's like 10,000 of them. If he created all these, and that's part of the story, is if he created all of this entire collection, they were like, there's no way he could have gotten rid of all of it. There's too much to get rid of all. Every bit of it was insane. Now, it wasn't until 1997 that he or pretty much anybody else would try to cash in on the stones. Now, part of what was actually talked about was that if he wanted to get rich from faking these artifacts, that he was terrible at it, if that was the idea. That he was absolutely terrible. It was very ill-executed. But there's more to the collection than just inscribed stones. Burroughs alleged that he had found and removed a lot of golden artifacts. And he brought a bunch out, had a bunch to show. Now, they look genuine. They also contain a mismatch of writing, pretty much. Different, you know, scribes, things, all kinds of wild stuff. I also read that there was a lot, more than a lot, of these gold artifacts were simply lead pours covered in gold paint.
Really?
So he had made these little lead designs of just basically common shapes, almost looked like a paperweight or a coaster, you know, and out of lead, and then had painted it gold and was trying to pass these things off to people as it had come from the Burroughs cave. Now, that being said, and like I said, there was a lot of people had bought a lot of these artifacts. People were buying them because they wanted to study them. You know, this is one of those things. I would like to have an artifact from that collection just because it's known possibly not to be, if not 100% not to be real. Now, if the story is true, there's another part here. Burroughs claims he discovered a human skeleton in that cave, a male, and there was a first crypt that he got into. And he also claims that there was a second chamber there that had the remains of a woman and two children, and that a golden spearhead, what you were talking about, lay inside the woman's ribs where the heart would have been, laid in there. And that the skulls of the children showed signs of perforation. So what they believe was that the women and children had all been murdered at the time of her, what they assumed to be, or he assumed to be, her husband had died. Now, Burroughs also claims, and still does, that in total that there were 12 crypts in that area. Now, the central chamber contained a golden sarcophagus that was closed by a stone that had to be rolled away. And the room, including the ceiling, was decorated with the white marble.
Really?
That's what he claims. Now, the golden sarcophagus inside the stone tomb, there was a stone tomb, you take the lid off, there's old Indiana Jones ideas.
Yeah.
Had some sort of ancient Egyptian form of burial, he claimed, and that it displayed the same style that was wearing the hair on the hair and also had the arms crossed on the body as if it was holding the symbols. So he's claiming
it
again.
He's claiming all this. No one actually saw
this. No one actually saw this. This is what he's claiming. It says also, too, that when he tried to pry open the sarcophagus and note that it seemed to contain human remains as well as a death mask, and like we said, thought to be Egyptian. Now, it says that the sarcophagus, of course, would have been of tremendous value. You could only imagine what that would have been if that would have been true. If it's true. If there was a true Egyptian sarcophagi, I believe that's what you call it, a sarcophagi?
Yeah.
Sarcophaga. If it's real. And that was really there. Could you imagine what it would have been worth?
Oh, it'd be priceless.
Instead of touching any of it, I would have shinnied out of the cave and been like, I got to call some folks.
Well, that's exactly the reason I don't think he was on the level.
Yes.
Because of that. Because, right, if you were to discover something, that don't you think you would call some archaeologists and go, hey, look, you know the thing Tutankhamun was buried in? I think I found one in a cave here on my property. But no. He kept it hushed.
Yeah.
He didn't allow anybody in there. Just a few people that he selected let go in there. And then he tried to sell off all these artifacts. So to me, it does seem like it's a con. He's trying to make money.
It seems that way. You're exactly right.
Because if it was real, don't you think you could just charge admission for anybody to come in here and look at this? And I mean, you people would pay $25, $35 a person, just like going to one of these caverns around
here.
Well,
not just that, just not even that. If he, of course, here's the thing, as I'm not sure, maybe he did own the land, maybe he bought the land, I'm assuming he bought it. I didn't look into that part of it. I can't remember what Harry Hubbard had actually said. I've listened to a few of his interviews because they were trying to buy the land that it was on. The neat thing is actually the paper there in July of 84, the paper, the Albany Daily Mail, actually ran a small article about the finding of this. And it's neat because part of the article actually says that the university that he's been in contact with will probably begin the dig next year. At some time, more information can be given. So allegedly, he was working with a university to try to get them to come out there. Now, I don't know how much truth is really involved in that whole thing, but I do know there was a fellow named Jackson Judge that had written a book about Burroughs, or actually that had edited the book about Burroughs, and that there's some interesting stuff.
What was the name of the, wasn't the book like The Mystery Cave of Many Faces?
The Discovery of Burroughs Cave is what this was. This one was basically a private publication from 1990. And I can read you some stuff. This is an interesting thing here. I'm going to read you that is actually what he claimed that he saw in the cave. It says, as I stood up and turned to begin the long walk out, I found myself falling into a pit that had been secreted beneath a large oval stone, which, as I later discovered, was fitted into the pit opening and designed to flip or turn over when stepped on and trap anyone who might have had the misfortune to find themselves in the position I now found myself in. I was very fortunate that when I stepped upon the stone, I was in the act of turning, and the stone, instead of turning over, slid off to one side and left the pit open. Says, I do not actually remember hitting bottom, but rather my next recollection is hanging onto the lip of the pit by my elbows and wondering, what kind of mess have I gotten myself into now? But there was something in my subconscious that compelled my returning to the bottom of that pit. I realized that I had not found myself knee-deep in snakes as I feared when I was falling, and so I dropped back to have a look at what was the greatest adventure of my life. And he goes on to talk about these strange symbols that he found, sealed doorways that he had found, but just that. This is what I want to get. Oh, there's even a part of a thing where he says that he had found a carving of an Amerindian of a face, but he said that the face, it wasn't that. They were different than any petroglyphs that he had seen, that the nose was flat and the eyes were wide and the lips were thick, which sounds like the black African race. The funny thing about this whole deal is that part, and that's the part that I wanted to read you. When I'm reading this whole part to you, this whole thing, what we just discussed, and I'm saying what he's written here is, I fell into this pit. It was booby-trapped. I caught myself on my elbows and tried to... Does that not sound like the tales of a man trying to be more important than what really is?
Yeah.
He's even telling a great story of, it was near death. I almost died trying to get... When I was reading that, I even visualized to myself Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, I think he saw it and was inspired.
It's the way it seems. It's just, and this is a scratch on the surface, folks. If you're interested in doing this, do yourself a favor. Go listen to some interviews on YouTube of Harry Hubbard. He does a great job talking about it. He's been in, and he's the guy on Illinois Cave. You can go to Facebook and see it, or listen to any of his podcasts that he's been on. We may have to get Harry, but that's not it. If you just start doing some research into this, there are so many crazy theories as to, first of all, Burroughs is a madman. I mean, he really, the whole dynamiting, let me get to that real quick.
Didn't he get pissed and seal the cave forever, right?
He got mad. He claims he dynamited it. And they also claim that they've done ground penetrating radar. People have claimed
that.
Oh,
they have. Because I was going to say, I've always wondered that. If he's dynamited the entrance to this thing and no one knows where it is, I'm like, they don't have any idea. I mean, you could look up through the county to see the title and deeds to the land he owned.
Yes.
So you'd be able to know where it is. You're telling me you can't go out there with ground penetrating radar and find this cave?
Well, he had never told anybody where it was at because I don't believe he owned it. I believe there was another person that owned the land. I wanted to say it was an older woman that had owned the land at the time.
But still, you could track that down, right?
You would think so, but how are you going to get on the property? It's private property. You can't just go traipsing around out there with your GPR. That's the best way to get gunshot.
Well, no, I'm not assuming that. I'm saying get permission from the landowner to search.
She wouldn't give it because Burroughs would cut her off or cut whoever off from that whole deal. That's what I'm telling
Even
you.
Even today, though, he's dead.
Even today, and that's why I think Hubbard's involved in it, is looking. I believe they found it. but it's flooded.
Conveniently.
Yeah. When it dynamited, it cracked. Apparently, it flooded with groundwater. Whatever the river that's close there to it has filled it up. Anything that could have been in there, they want to open up. I believe the guy that owns it, from what I'm, and this is all off of just recollection of what I heard, the man that owns the land now wants $1 million for it, for the land, because they want $1 million as a chance that maybe it's there. Now, this guy doesn't care anything in the world about looking forward to the whole deal. I think he just wants to make the money of it. Because here's the thing. If it's truly there, and there's all these inscriptions still inside this cave and stuff on the walls, it's well worth it.
Man.
But if it's not there, and you open it up, and it's just a hole in the ground, just an old rocky crag, and you just wasted $1 million. Well, it's not to that guy that wants, because here's the thing. He knows he can get $1 million now for somebody that wants to look in that cave bad enough. But if it's proven not to exist, then it's just another piece of land.
Let's start a GoFundMe.
Exactly.
Let's find the Burroughs Cave. You know, it's probably not real, but man, it does get my wheels spinning. I mean, imagine there's a large cache of Egyptian artifacts, sarcophaguses, things like that, buried somewhere in southeastern Illinois. That's incredible. I mean, and how many other caves are like
if
that?
It's
because
true.
What's the story of in the Grand Canyon?
We talked about it. I did the whole thing. Yeah.
Similar story, right? Whoever was there one time said that it was filled with treasure, countless treasure.
Well, and that's what I was going to tell you, is if you go, folks, and just check out some of the artifacts that come from the Burroughs Cave, you can look and be like, they kind of look cartoonish, some of them, the way they're drawn. Some of them look like they got aliens drawn on them. I mean, some of it looks...
Well, I've seen the gold coins and stuff that they found. It does... Look, I'm going to say, I've seen Egyptian hieroglyphics. They look really great, spot on. In fact, Christopher Dunn even
looks like
talks
done
about
with a machine.
It's been perfect.
Yeah.
These look very crude.
Yes, they
as
do.
As if somebody was trying to produce this.
Or was it because it was done here and they didn't have the equipment?
Well,
I mean, you know, that's one of those
things. That's the thing. You're never going to know.
What if he did find a few?
And then faked the rest.
And faked the rest. And that's always been the argument. Except for the person, apparently, he was a horrible,
person.
It
reminds me of the stones that they found in South America with the dinosaurs and stuff on them. Now, they do know that some of them are real, but then they also think that a small group of people were reproducing fakes for years
making
and
money,
selling them.
Making that money. Making that paper. It's a very interesting story. I would like to get Harry on, and I would like to listen to Harry,
you know what,
you know, talk just about that side of it.
That'd be awesome to speak to him. What's also weird about that area of Southern Illinois and stuff is that many of the towns have Egyptian-like names.
Yeah.
Like Cairo, actual Little Egypt.
Yeah.
Things like that. I mean, that is, what is that?
Yeah, why was it named that?
Yeah.
Did founding fathers know something from that area that they didn't
That's
let on
That's what always makes me go
else?
Crazy. You know, right. The same thing with the Sasquatch up in Washington and Oregon. I mean, some of those are Monkey Pass.
Yeah.
They're strange coincidences.
Right.
What is that?
It's fun to speculate, man. I don't know, but it's interesting. If nonetheless, folks, I urge you to check out anything about the Burroughs Cave or the Illinois Cave. Just look into it. It's a really interesting story, and it chases its tail on a lot of it.
But one of the best places, if you want to find information on things like this, is, man, Ancient American Magazine.
Yes, yes.
You can go there. You can get subscriptions. You can get the PDF versions for like $4, or you can get the actual subscription to it. It comes out with like 6 a year. And there's some great writers in there, great articles about things like that, Ancient American Magazine, if you're into that kind of thing. Well, let's take a break. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Hope everybody enjoyed those stories. I love to hear these pre-Columbian history stories. I love to think about it. I love to think about the Burroughs Cave because I'm a huge fan of, like you were talking about, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
You know why you love it? It's because you want it to be real.
Yeah. As a kid, I mean, who didn't want to have that bullwhip and that?
I want that excitement.
And hat.
I want that excitement.
And you go out there and you look for this treasure, right?
I want it. I want that excitement. I love the whole tales of all of these things. That's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. Folks, for all of y'all over there that's our English listenership, our good buddy, Mr. Micah Hanks, is going to be in y'all's neck of the woods Monday, October 9th. If you're out and about in London, make sure to check out Watching for UFOs, The Edges of Ufology. Now, this is going to be hosted by the London 14 Society. Now, y'all can find it on Facebook, and it says it's going to be at the Bell in 50 Middlesex Street. and I don't even know what kind of crazy address they have over there. E17X London. I don't even know what that's all about. But anyway, make sure you swing by, see Mr. Micah Hanks. He's going to be talking about UFO and the UFO singularity, his book. Go check it out if you're there.
Man, I wish I was going.
Man, you don't know how bad
I wanted to go. Wasted all our money on the paradigm. We didn't even get to go.
Doggone paradigm. Yeah, so that's one thing. So make sure if you're down with the ufology, check it out. You can go by there, harass Micah Hanks. Tell him you're down with the brud. He'll know exactly what you're talking about. Go up there and shake his hand, right? Pat him on the back. Ask him if he's got his sonic screwdriver.
He was complaining the other day that the new Doctor Who series, that they did away with the sonic screwdriver and he no longer uses it.
He's crushed.
Yeah,
he's crushed. I'm going to have to talk to Mike about that. Well, folks, we have had a great Columbus Day, I suppose, if you can have a great one.
Yeah.
It is it's silly. It's something that we like to poke fun at. So thank you all for coming along. And
thank you for the reviews.
Yeah, thank you so much for the reviews. Yes, very, very, very much. We're going to be getting to some shout-outs coming real, real soon. Keep them coming, please, folks. We love that y'all rate and review the show. It keeps it up there in the top, lets other people find that it does awesome for us. We really, really appreciate it. Also, thank you to everybody that's been emailing the show, sending us links, sending us information, making my head hurt. And I've already got a big head. I mean, it's like, I got like a funny shaped melon, and then y'all keep filling it with more information. It's going to crack.
Yeah. If you want to share your stories, you can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can also call the show if you'd prefer to tell the story. That number is 817-945-3828. Also, if you like Expanded Perspectives and you want more, don't forget there is Expanded Perspectives Elite. It's easy to do. Go to the website, expandedperspectives.com. Click on the Elite tab. Signing up is easy. It's $5. I mean, it's really cheap. It's about the price of a normal lunch. And for that, you can get 60-something episodes, and they're all there. The back catalog is there.
For now.
And you'll get an extra episode every Thursday. And since this is the month of October, we're going to be doing scary monsters and things like that. In the last episode, we talked about werewolves and dogmen. And this Thursday, we're going to be talking about some other scary stuff. So if you want to tune in, please sign up at expandedperspectives.com. Cam.
Yes, sir.
An interesting show. I know it's an interesting day. A lot of people are off work today, at least here in the United States anyways. So I hope everybody has a good one. Have you been following Major League Baseball?
Of course.
Right?
I live in Texas, don't I?
That's right. The Cubbies. The series is split. They make me so nervous. I hope they beat St. Louis.
I do too. I completely agree.
I'm just glad the Yankees didn't make it.
Yay! High five across the table. That's what I'm talking about.
All right. Well, everybody have a good week. For all you elite members, we'll speak to you on Thursday. For everybody else, we'll see you next week. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Peace.